Hello everyone, and welcome to this fifth episode of the History and Stuff podcast. On popular demand, I'm going back to history of Sweden today, on the suggestion of some of my listeners. I did a poll as well, and the results were overwhelmingly in favor of today's topic, so I will oblige. However, I do think I will also do the other suggestion I had, which is a more true crime style episode. I haven't done that before, and I thought it would be fun to do, especially since I have a particular idea in mind. And it's soon Halloween anyway, so that would be fitting, right? For my Swedish listeners, I have kind of a hint for what it will be about. It will be about someone I will call Snabba Tommy. I hope you find that out. So, today we're talking about some good old-fashioned political history in Sweden. We will mainly be covering the democratization as well as the unionization of Sweden. The period I will examine starts in about 1850 and ends in about 1950. While Sweden's democratization was pretty much completed by 1950, there are still some interesting things in the period 1930 to 50 that I want to discuss. So, like with most stories, let's start from the beginning. In the year 1850, Sweden was a very poor and rural country with very limited industry and a very aged political system. In some parts of Sweden, most notably Småland, as well as some parts of northern Sweden, there were still periodic famines. The year 1867 was especially bad, and it's known as the last big famine in Swedish history. This led, together with other factors, such as population growth, to the start of the Swedish Great Migration to the US, which went on from about 1850 to about 1920. Mostly Minnesota and Chicago was made home to about a million Swedish immigrants throughout these years. And there were also revival movements that were banned by Swedish governments that also led a lot of people to move to the United States. And there were also a lack of land for the farming class. Although Sweden was very much still an agricultural country, there was a slow industrialization that did start around 1850, meaning that many people moved from the countryside to areas with more industrialized jobs, like cities, but also smaller logging towns or mining towns. This made the old estate system seem very outdated. Since ordinary workers had no representation in that system, and even very wealthy, like industrial tycoons, they didn't have a class that sort of fit any of the estates. So there were a lot of calls for changing that. And there was also increasing prosperity, even among the poorer social classes at this time. And this is sometimes attributed to the peace, the vaccine, and the potatoes, as a great Swedish author by name Esaias Tegnér once said. And Sweden had been in peace since 1815, which is seen as a very important contributor to Swedish later prosperity, as well as a number of innovations such as the modern ball bearing and a number of other exports that turn up later on. But when we take a look back at the parliament, in the year 1850, the Swedish parliament was still divided into the four estates that had existed since feudal times. These estates were farmers, burghers like the bourgeoisie, clergy, and nobility. And they all had equal voting power to each other, but of course the farmers were most of the people, and the burghers were still a quite large amount of people, but the clergy and nobility were very, very few, so they were vastly overrepresented. And they also tended to vote together, which meant that any suggestion that needed a majority of the estates, it could never get through. And this parliament had traditionally just been a council for the king, who was in theory like as the sole ruler of Sweden. And in fact, the Swedish constitution said that the king would be the sole ruler all the way until 1973. But already by 1850, this was a relic of the past, and the king didn't really have much practical power, and parliament had taken over most of the duties of the king. And this old system was, by many liberals, as well as even some conservatives, seen as an unfit system for a modern state. You know, they realized that the old time of farmers and nobility is gone, and it's new time. And many European states had already abandoned this sort of system of estates in favor of a more proportional representation, at least for wealthier men. So by 1860, it was very clear that something had to change sooner or later, and people started putting forward suggestions to Parliament, and even the king, as well as a sizable portion of the nobility, were positive to a change in representation, although pretty much none of them favored one person, one vote representation, but they favored a class-based representation or a wealth-based representation. So they would still preserve a disproportionate amount of influence. And even reformists agreed that rich people should have more votes than poor people. So a suggestion was placed on the parliament's table in 1863. And after a few years of debating and adjusting, a suggestion was voted on in 1865 in all four estates, which had to pass all of them in order to be implemented. And the parliament that would follow would be bicameral, so it would have two chambers, one more directly elected and one more indirectly elected, kind of like Britain, where they had the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And the new parliament would also get rid of special privileges for nobility and clergy, but they would still have a lot of power since they were rich. And the press was overwhelmingly positive to the new reform, although many farmer and burgher representatives argue that the reform was insufficient and that even more radical reform was needed. Some criticism also came from conservative sources that argued that, you know, this would mean mob rule and the church would lose all its influence, although even at the time this was a very marginal opinion. And the reform was passed by clear majority in all four chambers, although the noble estate had the closest vote. Although it should be noted that the class of the nobility basically just voted their own privileges away. Like, they probably could have kept them at least for a while, but they decided, no, we just vote them away. Although they would still get disproportionately represented, so maybe this was just a move to look more liberal. Or whatever. However, this reform did not make Sweden a democracy in the modern sense. Only men could vote, as well as some corporations, and wealthy men had several votes, while poorer men had fewer votes, and if you didn't pay tax, you couldn't vote at all. So it's not a democracy in the modern sense. And of course, women couldn't vote. The vote of women was propagated for by liberals, as well as the early social movement, even quite early on, and they wanted equal voting for workers as well as women. And the temperance movement, which was very, very strong in Sweden, had a widespread influence in this issue as well, and they propagated for more inclusive voting. While liberals and socialists both argued for more voting rights, only the Social Democratic Party favored more aggressive tactics, like striking. And in the late 1800s and late early 1900s, the suffragist movement started taking hold in Sweden. Although they were criticized for their unwillingness to argue for the vote of poorer men by some socialists, which led to sort of few disagreements between socialist women and more upper class or middle class women. The methods used by the suffragists were notably less aggressive than the British movement used. The British movement was infamous for using arson at times, as well as property damage and civil disobedience. But the Swedish movement was much more moderate, and that was partly because they looked at the British movement and saw how they were painted. So they tried to do the opposite and tried to dress very feminine and appear not as, you know, they were often characterized as being, you know, lesbians and mannish. So they tried to do the opposite of that. And they would instead collect name signatures, they would petition legislators, they would publish their arguments in the media. And important leaders for this movement were early on Fredrika Bremer, and later on we had Elin Wägner, who was one of the main campaigners for when it actually passed. And in 1909, equal votes for men was instituted, with some notable exceptions for welfare recipients. But this meant that 1 million men had the vote in 1909. So this meant even workers. And in 1919, this was also adjusted to include women, as well as many other countries did at this time, because World War I had just ended and a lot of women had worked in factories and it worked fine. And you couldn't really make the argument anymore that, you know, women were frail and they couldn't work. That argument just didn't fly anymore. And women obviously had a very important role in society. And a lot of countries decided to expand the franchise. Although notably, France didn't do this. In Sweden, this change was pushed through with the left-wing liberal alliance. And the right-wing party was against this at the time. And this means that I think Sweden can rightly be called a democracy from this date on, 1919, or possibly 1921, which was when the first election with women voting was. But it should be noted that there were still some restrictions, such as welfare recipients couldn't vote. If you had tax debts, you couldn't vote. If you were a criminal, you couldn't vote. And if you hadn't done armed service for the military, if you were a man, you also couldn't vote. And the Romani community was also disenfranchised, although this was more indirect, since they were mostly not registered anywhere as citizens. So when they were allowed to register as citizens in the 50s, they also got the vote. And an important factor in the fight for voting rights throughout this period was the Swedish Social Democratic Workers' Party, which I will shorten SAP, which is the Swedish acronym, and it was founded in 1889. They were also the founding force behind LO, which coordinates a large portion of Swedish unions, even today. They're kind of the collecting force for all the sort of working class unions. The party propagated early on for equal voting, but they also had the core issue of an 8-hour working day, which is actually still in practice in most of Sweden today. Although, of course, some types of work have other working times, but the sort of industrial standard is still 8 hours. This party also had a more radical offshoot, which eventually became known as the Swedish Communist Party. And even later on, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it changed to the Left Party. And these two parties are the dominant left-wing parties of Sweden, even until today, with the Social Democratic Party being much bigger. And they basically have been the only two parliamentary left-wing parties in Sweden. For large parts of the 1900s, the SAP, or the Social Democratic Party, has been very, very dominant in Swedish politics. It has almost always been the largest party, and it has been in power for most of the period from the 30s up until today. There have been some power shifts to the right liberal alliance, but that had never lasted more than two terms. And it should be noted that the SAP was not a communist party, and by 1920 they weren't really even socialist in a looser term. They weren't trying to abandon capitalism. They were a more pragmatic party with very attainable and very reasonable goals to a lot of people. This meant that they could sort of champion these issues without being seen as too radical or too far left. And the other parties that opposed them were also often not in agreement, because you had both liberal parties and you had right-wing parties that had to cooperate in order to keep the Social Democrats out. And they were unable to do this for most of the time. They tended to squabble a lot. So the Social Democratic Party has managed to dominate the parliament for almost 100 years straight. However, if you look outside of the workers' movement, some of the other movements that very strongly contributed to the democratization of Sweden was the temperance movement, I've already mentioned that, as well as the free church movement or the revival movement. And they were very important institutions in Sweden at the time in order to help the democratization. They're known as the people's movements collectively with the workers' movement. And they gave people a place to discuss politics and a place to read, because often these places had libraries. You know, you went to a temperance lodge and you were the only library in a large area. And you could also participate in an organization that fought for a political goal. So even if, you know, these people would later on support other parties, they learned how to organize and they learned how to fight for a political cause in the temperance movement or the free church movement. They were also democratically run and thus helped grow the idea of political participation. Although the temperance movement ultimately failed in its main political goal of legalizing the purchase and use of alcohol, they lost a referendum pretty narrowly in the 1920s. But Sweden still has a very restrictive alcohol policy, even today. There are very, very heavy taxes on alcohol, and alcohol can only be bought above a certain percentage of alcohol at a single store, if you're not at the pub, for example. And now we move back to social democracy. And one of the main ideas of the Social Democratic Party that was seen as kind of an attainable idea for a lot of people was the idea of folkhemmet, or the people's home. This was an idea of having a quite high living standard for everyone, not just those with a particular talent or those who have a very particular drive for greatness, which I would say would be more like the American dream. But this is the Swedish dream, where everyone can have a pretty high standard of living. You know, nothing too fancy, but everyone should have a basic standard. Everyone should have a home, everyone should be able to have a car, everyone should be able to have time for leisure. And this social democratic approach also put strict controls on parts of the economy, such as the previously mentioned alcohol, as well as medicine, which for a long time was also monopolized. But the system also developed a very hands-off approach in some ways, which might not be what people expect. For example, when it came to union conflicts between employers and employees, or unions and employer organizations, the government has a policy of non-intervention to a very large extent, and the negotiation of the new deals are left up to the market parties, as they're called, the unions and the representatives for the employers. This means, for instance, that we don't really have a minimum wage, legal minimum wage in Sweden. We have several minimum wages for different kinds of work. They're practically as a minimum wage. It's just that it is negotiated not by the government, but by the unions and the employer organizations. And this has led to relatively few strikes and other sort of aggressive measures and relatively minor union conflicts in recent times. However, this system was instituted in 1938 in what's called the Saltsjöbadsavtalet, the Saltsjöbaden deal. And conflicts between employers and employees before this time was not only frequent, but also sometimes very violent. In the third episode of this podcast, I talked about the Amalthea bombing, which was an attack on strikebreakers by a number of young socialists. And this killed one person, and it was done in spite of heavy military and police protection. So these people did not play around. Sometimes these conflicts got very violent. But 1914 to 1918 was probably the most explosive in terms of like political strife between left and right. Many conservatives were very worried about the state of the Swedish army, and they marched on the capital to demand rearmament. And the king decided to go out and meet the crowd, basically. And he basically said that he agreed with them that the state should not have disarmed to this extent. And he said that he should have more funding for his army or his navy, which was not what he was supposed to say because he didn't have any political power at this time. But still, having a king that disagreed with government policy meant that the government had to step down, because this was an untenable position. So a conservative government took its place, but the king was forced after this to agree to never make party political statements anymore. And the Swedish monarchy still maintains this policy even to this day. However, if we look on the left side of the political spectrum during this time, 1914 to 1918, the groups of socialists and anarchists were very fractured, but they were also very eager to act. The Russian Revolution, which of course happened during this time, roughly, had led a lot of people to think that revolutionary goals were very attainable and revolution was just around the corner. So they organized very large demonstrations in rural areas as well as urban areas. Because we're talking about the period around World War I, even if Sweden was outside the war, there were very high food prices and rationing. And this led to a lot of hungry people, and the socialists decided to seize on this moment and seize on the popular anger to fuel it in service of the revolution. So in a lot of places, angry mobs basically plundered food stores, and this led the military to deploy at several places in order to restore order. And there were also fears of a military revolt in the establishment, and this led to the government keeping the military under check. However, a military revolt was not very likely. And there were also large demonstrations that were crushed by riding police who famously used sabers on the demonstrators. And this is called the bloodbath on Gustav Adolf's Torg, which is Gustav Adolf's square. However, the most violent clash of Swedish Union demonstrators and the authorities did not happen in 1914 to 1918. It happened in 1931, and it happened in a place called Ådala, and it's quite famous to most Swedish people. It started off with a standoff between chemical factory workers and their employers, because they had lowered the wages of the workers. And the workers, of course, did not like this, and they started striking. So the employers decided, well, we'll just fire you, and we'll bring in strikebreakers. So they brought in workers by ship in order to nullify the strike. But this was met with very harsh resistance from the striking workers. And when the boat arrived with the strike breakers, they were pretty severely beaten up by striking workers, at least according to some sources. And since police were unable to handle the situation, they were unable to stop the violence, they called in military reinforcements, because there was no Swedish national police force that they could just call in for backup, but they just had the local police force. So the workers, they grew, because a lot of people decided to strike in solidarity with this chemical worker strike. So a lot of people decided to march on the factory and on the strike breakers. So around 3,000 to 4,000 people gathered at a place called Lunde, and they decided to march on the factory. And they marched towards the military as well, and some of the people threw rocks at the military. So the military decided to tell the demonstrators that basically, if you don't disperse, you will be treated as rebellious. And when they arrived to the sort of roadblock that the military had set up, an officer claims that he saw weapons, although there is absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever. And he said that the soldiers should open fire and shoot on the ground ahead of the workers. So they opened fire, and of course the workers started dispersing. And the officer claims that he thought this meant that they were trying to evade them and attack them. So they opened fire on the protesters, killing five and wounding five others. One of the people killed was just a bystander who wasn't even in the march. And interestingly enough, she had family in the same village that my father grew up in. So my father comes from roughly this area, and I have cousins there. So the soldiers only stopped firing when the worker had remembered the ceasefire signal from his military training. So he blew the signal, and the soldiers stopped firing. A very brave act, which he was charged for, since it's illegal to take control of a military force. Although, fortunately, he was not convicted. And the gravestone of these workers has a quote on it that I will read now, first in Swedish and then in English. Här vilar en svensk arbetare, stupad i fredstid, vapenlös, värnlös, arkebuserad av okända kulor. Brottet var hunger. Glöm honom aldrig. Here lies a Swedish worker, fallen in peacetime, without arms and without means to defend himself. Shot by unknown bullets, his crime was hunger. Never forget him. So of course this has left a very large impact on Swedish society, and military has never been used for crown control ever again domestically. And the events were of course very differently covered based on the ideology of the paper. The right-wing papers tended to blame the workers, blame the rioters, as they said, and they supported the military. And the military did nothing wrong, and the workers were to blame. However, the left-wing papers said that this was cold-blooded murder of demonstrating workers that were exercising their free speech. And even some social democrats tended to basically blame both sides, saying, you know, the military was wrong, but also it wouldn't happen if the workers hadn't been so rowdy. Especially the sort of more establishment-friendly parts of the Social Democratic Party was on this side of issues. So trials were held, but none of the soldiers or officers were ever charged with anything severe. And some of the demonstrators were also convicted for rioting, as well as a few other crimes. And as I mentioned before, there are still laws based on this event that ban Swedish military from backing up police in duties of crowd control. And it's still illegal to this day because of this event. So I will read a short passage from the report as a sort of finish of this episode, where they talk about, you know, the reaction to this event. And once again, I'll read it first in Swedish and then in English. Det finns sålunda anledning att icke lägga allt för tung ansvarsbörda på den militära befälhavaren. Men även om detta beaktas, måste varje tänkande människa reagera på att det som hände överhuvud skulle behöva inträffa. En kravall som i något av rikets större städer säkerligen kunna avvärjas med relativt ringa polisstyrka utan andra skador än några krossår, föranledda i detta fall det ohyggliga resultatet av 5 dödade och 5 sårade. Enligt kommissionens mening visar detta med styrka på vad som redan förut framhållits, nämligen vilket olämpligt medel för ordningens upprätthållande militären i sådana fall är, där det icke är fråga om att möta en öppet beväpnad motståndare. So the commission basically says that the commander can't be solely blamed for the events, but still that it is worth noting that this probably wouldn't have happened if the military hadn't been there. And that basically crowd control should never be the responsibility of the military, because the military is good at facing opponents with arms that are attacking them. And the police could probably have diffused the situation, maybe with some police brutality, but not, and no one would be killed. Probably someone would maybe be injured. So they're basically saying the military is very bad at crowd control, and the police could do a better job. So I think this episode was quite interesting to write. It's maybe a lot of information about the representational reform that some of you might find boring, but I actually did one of my college theses on this, so I thought I'm never going to use it in any other time, so I decided to use it here. And I've also used some other sources, like the book The Swedish Success Story, that's kind of an anthology on Swedish society. I also used a book called The Swedish Revolution, 1917-18, although you probably won't find it at your local library. There is a lot of information about the democratization of Sweden and such in other sources as well. So with that, I would like to thank you very much for listening. And as I said, I will probably do the true crime episode the next time about Snabba Tommy. And I hope to hear you next time. Goodbye.